Okay, good. Do you want me
Alrighty.
To do attendance first?
Yes, please do.
Okay, so here, so what we'll do is I will identify the people who we have identified so far as being online, and then ask for any additional RSVPs. And then if anybody else after that would like to be identified that I don't identify, you can go ahead and identify yourself at that time. So right now, excuse the laughter in the background. We definitively have on the line the following: Amanda Backus from Coventry, Jim Hayden from East Granby, John Ward from Granby, Jack McCoy from Manchester, Robert Lee from Plainville, Melissa Appleby from Simsbury, Mike Rosen from Tolland, Peter Souza from Windsor, from Crog, we have Kim Bona, Jessica Muirhead, Pauline Yoder, Cheryl Assis, and Lyle Ray. We have from New Energen, Brett Wu, doing a quick look, there are some additional people that I have not called out or recognized. If you want to state your name and your town, if applicable at this point in time, that'd be great. If you're on the phone and you need to unmute yourself, it's star 4.
Hi, Tony Moran from Mansfield.
Anybody else who wishes to identify themselves? Okay. Just a reminder, in terms of housekeeping, if you're on the phone and you want to unmute yourself, it's star 4, and then star 4 to remute yourself.
All right, Pauline, thank you very much. This is Peter Souza. Thank you all for joining us today. We're going to get started with today's meeting by adopting, can I have a motion to adopt the minutes of the January 14th, 2020 meeting?
So move, Plainville.
Is there a second?
Seconded.
Who was it who seconded?
Jack.
Oh, thank you, Jack. Sorry.
Great. Is there any adjustments to the minutes? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting as presented, please say aye.
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 Are there any oppositions or abstentions?
I think I should abstain. I don't think I was there.
Melissa?
Yeah.
Right. I wasn't there either, so abstaining.
Before you speak, if you could say your name, that would be great. It has to be each and every time before you speak. Who was it who just abstained?
Tony Moran from Mansfield. My
Thank
apologies.
You.
And Melissa from Simsbury.
Thank you.
All right. Great. Thank you, folks. We're going to go into public comment. And I believe we have Brett from New Energen that has a few comments.
Yes, this is Brett Wu from New Energen. Thank everybody for your time here. I hope everyone's safe and healthy. Just want to take a few minutes to introduce myself. I'm a senior director of major accounts at New Energen. And as you may know, New Energen will be supporting CROG going forward on energy procurement services and a bunch of any other consulting services following an RFP that we responded to last year. And we're going to be doing a lot of coordination over the next day or two with the CROG program leaders to figure out how we're going to be working with each of the various municipalities and agencies that you all represent. So there'll be a lot coming from us towards your attention in the next couple of weeks as we look to replace your existing energy supply contracts. And just wanted to say hello and thank you for giving us the opportunity to serve.
Very good. Thank you very much, Brett. We look forward to working with you in the next year or so.
Thank you very much, all.
All righty, Pauline, I'm going to ready to move on to item three? All right, so item three, a series of questions that hopefully will frame a conversation of sharing information from each, how each of our towns are managing through the response to the pandemic. Pauline and I thought we would kind of take these in order just to make it a little bit easier. Maybe not quite as free-flowing as I usually run the meeting, but I'll try to actually stay in one place, not try to eat my sandwich too much in front of the camera. But let's start off with that first question, which is trying to get a sense of how we're each handling staffing or scheduling across the board, but with particular questions related to like police department, if you have a police department and your public works functions. Particularly. So, Pauline, I can't recall how we wanted to structure this. We just gonna let people jump in and start off.
I think that's what we decided. And if it becomes a little chaotic, we could have people use either the chat function or the raise hand function. If people start, but I think there's a few enough people that I think we could manage it.
Okay, great. Would anybody like to start off and kind of give us a high overview of what you're working, how you're addressing staffing and scheduling?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, this is Keith Chapman from the town of Newington. How we're handling public works is we have two shifts, working 35 hours apiece. A shift works Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 10 hours. 5 hours on Wednesday morning. The B shift works 5 hours Wednesday afternoon, and then 10 hours Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Right. And Keith, this is Peter. Do you usually do a 37 and a half or a 40-hour work week?
We normally do a 40-hour work week, but because they're not getting paid any overtime for working the Saturdays and Sundays, they're getting paid for 40 hours, but they're only working 35 hours.
Great. Thanks, Keith.
So their 35 hours is at straight time. If they are called in outside of their regular, we'll say COVID-19 hours, then they're paid overtime.
Great. Is Newington doing anything different in terms of your police department staffing?
No, all of our police are expected to report every day, and we've not had any issues whatsoever with the police department.
Thanks, Keith. Anybody else have doing anything different with from a DPW, police, or otherwise?
Peter's Jim Hayden from East Granby. We are such a small town that. We're not able to do split shifts or anything like that at this point. We've got full staff for DPW, full staff for police. We are encouraging other departments to take time off, so we're trying to be one person in every office, but that's voluntary at this point. So we haven't done anything specifically other than encourage people to use some time off if they wanted to do so.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Peter?
Yes.
Mansfield is doing, this is Tony Moran again. Mansfield is doing something a little different. We are alternating shifts, but we have very small teams in DPW, about three people a team. They're social distancing, one person to a piece of equipment, so they're not sharing equipment. And they are continuing to do road work. We have had quite a bit of work that needs to be done both in public works and facilities. And so far everybody is fully employed. And we're also finding that we are sharing work between departments so that if Parks and Recs need something to be done and there's a public works person available, they will swap jobs temporarily. Or fill in the gaps is what I really mean, not swap jobs.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for sharing that. Hey, Melissa, would you mind me calling on seeing what Simsbury's up to?
Sure. So for DPW specifically, we're doing the two-shift model, so having sort of an A squad and a B squad, 3 days on, 2 days off, and then the off team is getting paid to be home, but the expectation is that they will be available to come in if needed, and then the following week that the team switch and do the other 3 days and 2 days. In terms of the police, our patrol officers, we haven't changed any of their shifts. In terms of the admin staff, to the extent that we can have people working from home, the detectives, community services officer, we've set them up to work remotely just to plan for redundancy should anything happen to the officers that are on the road. And then just the chief and lieutenants are reporting to the office at this point.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, so I was going to say, Tallinn is a bit of a mixture of a couple of the things we've already talked about. We, for public works specifically, we normally have 40-hour-a-week employees. They work Monday to Friday. So instead, we put them on summer hours right now where they're having 40 hours within 4 days. So they're doing 10-hour days, a Monday to Thursday shift, and then a Tuesday to Friday shift. Same thing as Mansfield, one worker, one piece of equipment. So they're not sharing, they're not contaminating or cross-contaminating. We use the state troopers, so they do their own thing over there. On the administrative side, and I forgot to mention too with public works that everyone is still fully staffed. We don't have anybody furloughed or working from home or anything. We are still at full composition. And for for the administrative staff throughout Tallinn, we also are sort of on a two-shift system where we have people that are, it's a case-by-case basis depending on department. But there are some departments that have just one or two people in them. So one person is home this week, one person's in the office, they switch next week. And for wherever possible people are working from home, we're doing that. But it's not the same. There are a lot of essential functions. Truly, we're mostly a staff of department heads anyway here. So we're all still in the office, including myself. And this is our third week of doing this model. And it seems to be working. The people who are home appreciate the opportunity to be safe from home at least every other week.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Does anybody else have anything, any different models that they're using other than what folks have shared so far?
This is Jack McCoy. Just a question. I mean, we're doing the temperature taking business at the beginning of shifts. I was wondering if anybody had any trouble with that. We most agreed to it. A little bit of muttering at the water and sewer plant, but basically that was the only adaption. Yep. Other than what folks have all said.
I know in Windsor, our police department, we've been taking temperature with our police folks. We haven't done it in public works because we're working, we've split our folks up into smaller groups. We'll probably be looking at public works going forward as we start to bring back them in a different staffing or scheduling just because to try to keep up with the workload as the grass starts to take off here in the next couple of weeks. I'm not sure if anybody from South Windsor's on. I know South Windsor has been taken. They have agreements with all their bargaining groups to do temperatures. That's my understanding. I think that's went fairly well from what Michael told me a couple of weeks ago.
Hi, Peter. It's Scott Roberts. I'm on. And yes, we are temping everybody in and there's no problems whatsoever. We also have a Team C, which is a permanently stay-at-home team based off medically compromised individuals. And they are only going to be called in case Team A or Team B go down.
Gotcha.
Yeah, this is Jack. Basic Air people, we've got about 130 people working at home or off-site. It's move as many out as we could, essentially.
That was the goal.
And they're all VPN'd in back to the network, to the various desktops or applications that they use.
Great.
Peter, sorry, Mike Rosen from Tallinn. One just other thing I wanted to mention is that another option that we've had for some folks, or just as we come down the stretch and as this starts to take off more prevalent in our neck of the woods, is some of the folks who are working from home, if we need to call them back to potentially staff shifts at the EOC, we've floated that idea. It would be mostly administrative tasks like answering phones or taking messages or sitting on webinars and taking notes and things like that. But it's just another way that we're keeping people paid. And you know, potentially when work runs out or something down the line, we want to keep people whole as much as possible.
Yeah. So, well, that's a good segue into the second question regarding furloughs and layoffs. I know that's what I've been spending end of last week and this week on, doing some different analysis on that. Up until this date, in Windsor's case, we pretty much kept everyone whole. And that was our decision early on, but we're getting to the point now where if we're looking out 4 to 5 more weeks with restrictions, then we're now taking a serious look at furloughs. So I was wondering what folks are doing at this point, either part-time, full-time positions.
This is Tony Moran from Mansfield again. The one limitation, of course, is the funding for education is contingent about keeping everybody on board. So of course, most of those people are really working hard because of the schooling at home. So we aren't even talking about that. Our issues have been arising around our community center, where we have a lot of part-time teachers and instructors, people whose classes don't run unless there are registrants, and there are, of course, no registrants. So some of those people have been, I don't know whether you call it furloughed. Their contracts have been terminated in any case, and we're providing assistance to them to get into some of the programs. We are a self-insured town for unemployment insurance, so every time we let somebody go, it bites into our budget too. So there's a real incentive for us to find work for people.
Thank you, Tony. Anybody else instituted furloughs yet? I mean, we're at that same boat where we pretty much are looking at our user fee or enterprise funds that are revenue-based. Those are the folks that we're looking at predominantly, as well as potentially our library. We have a large contingent of part-time folks at the library, so we're looking at that. My understanding is that the towns are going to be able to have the potential of getting reimbursement from through one of the federal programs. And so that's what I'm counting on. If we do end up furloughing folks, that we'll be able to get back a portion of our 50%, because we're similar to you, Tony, where we're basically pay as we go on the unemployment side.
This is Melissa in Simsbury. The only furloughs we've done are for part-time pages at the library. And those are just folks that are averaging like 8-9 hours a week, and it's all public facing. So they were unaffiliated positions, and those are the only ones we don't have working in some capacity right now.
All right. Anybody else at the stage have, or at the stage of issuing furloughs? All right. Well,
I just want to say that one of our most vociferous budget cutters, low taxes proponents, started out saying we should absolutely let people go, and has now come on board to say keep people employed as long as possible. I think she must be seeing some of the impact of furloughs in the community.
Well, that's a silver lining, perhaps, to all this mess.
Well, I don't know how long it will last, but I'm not counting on it. But it was a surprise.
Yeah. All righty. Anybody else have anything to add, additional to add on number two?
I have a question. My concern right now is with first responders and the potential need for quarantine or isolation. Does this fit into this question, or is it for a later question?
Oh, I think you're going to take it right now, if you want, Tony.
Well, we have a small fire department, and most of the people are EMTs, and there have been increasing numbers of calls for people with COVID symptoms, COVID-like symptoms. So at the moment, out of our 16 full-time firefighters, two are in quarantine, although they're probably going to be okay. And one of our part-time firefighters is also in quarantine. He had a contact through his other work. So one of the things that we're concerned about is finding housing for people who are not sick but need to be quarantined and away from their families. And I'm wondering if you guys have coped with anything like that.
Tony, I can speak from what we've done in Windsor. Fortunately, we've not had to use it, but we do have a fair number of hotels here in Windsor, so we've been able to access that. So we've basically reserved a block of rooms at no cost to us at this point. But I'm wondering if UConn might be able to play with some of their dormitories that they might be able to make available.
Well, that was a question I was going to ask later for people who have major state institutions in their communities. All of this is being handled through their emergency management team, and we have verbal promises that if we need something, they will provide. But so far, we're also hearing that the spaces that they are making available are for their own first responders rather than for the public. And also that even if we use them, that we will have to pay for food and laundry and bring our own linens. And it's beginning to look like it's too complicated to make it work.
Hmm. Interesting. Anybody have any insights for Tony, perhaps?
Well, UConn's our elephant in the room, so.
Well, sounds like a good chance to get to know the new president even better.
Yes, indeed.
All righty.
Peter, can I just raise something related but not exactly an answer to Tony's question?
Please, Mike.
So this has to do with also with first responders since we're on the subject. I met with my public works director and my fire chief earlier this week, and we talked about the new FMLA law that went into effect that gives not only the 2 weeks if you yourself are quarantined, but also up to an additional 10 weeks if you have a child that's in the school system. There's an exemption clause for first responders. And what my fire and DPW directors have said was it would be great if we had a regional response about exemptions to that so that each town is doing the same thing in our area. Do we want to exempt the first responders from the 10-week provision? So, you know, I know it's kind of a tough decision to do because they're humans too, and they have kids in schools that are closed, but these are our people that signed up to do these tough jobs. And if they're ducking out, that's a problem. And because we're not going to have manpower to go to the scenes of fires or medical emergencies. So I just wanted to float that by the group about if we wanted to have a regional approach about exemption.
Has anyone addressed that specifically to Mike's question? I'm trying to find my email because we did act on that, and I'm just trying to find out. I think we did three out of the four. There's four exclusions there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did the. I'm just trying to get that. I'll get that to you, Mike, what we did here. I just got to find out exactly.
Yeah, and I get the point that the chief was saying was that if we have a town, if the next neighboring town, Coventry or Mansfield, if they're doing something differently, there's going to be grumblings amongst the workers saying, right. "Oh man, I wish I worked for that town. They're given exemption. Or they're not doing exemptions." So we're leaning here because we are such a small force here that if a couple of people, we only have 6 firefighters. That's it, full time. So if one or two or any of them use that clause, we're pretty in trouble. And that also accounts for public works too. So just something to float by the group.
Is there any initial reaction, folks, in terms of doing it on a either regional or sub-regional basis? Or has anybody addressed that individually so far?
Tony Moran again. I heard a discussion about, not about this, but about whether doctors and nurses and those kind of medical responders ought to be able to not go in if they're afraid. And one of the issues is, I'm not sure you want somebody working who's distracted or afraid. We haven't raised this question, but I will ask it at our department head meeting tomorrow.
All righty. Mike, I just sent an email to my personnel director. I'm going to see if she's had any conversations with her colleagues around the region and see if she's got any insight to that in terms of a common approach.
Thank you. That's great. I appreciate it.
It's pretty scary when I'm trying to talk and type at the same time. That's pretty good for me. All righty, where are we now, Pauline?
We're at question 3. Sorry, I had muted myself because there's lots of noise in the background here. It was a question on public meetings. If you've conducted a public meeting, what has been the challenges with that? Things that you thought worked well and things that you would do differently if you could do it any over again? Any Zoom bombing issues or protections against Zoom bombing? I think there's different ways that you can structure the meeting so that you're protected against that without restricting public access at the same time, which is the balance and the challenge that municipalities face.
All right. Any good experiences out there? Any wounds that are barely starting to heal that you want to share?
This is Bob Lee from Plainville. We're only allowing the public to call in and listen and not participate video-wise. Video is only by invitation only.
Okay.
Peter, Jim Hayden in East Granby. We've had several commission and board meetings, and they don't make great Let's See TV, that's for sure, but they seem to get the job done. So we're okay from that perspective. We're going to be having a virtual budget public hearing the first week of May, and so we're trying to work through some of the logistics for that. But so far, so good. There's several of the smaller commissions have just canceled their meetings to date. I was on, as many of us probably were, on a call with a lieutenant governor, and I think it was on the women's suffrage or the vote, get out the vote, and they got bombed pretty obscenely. But so far, so good. So that we got a meeting tomorrow night, so I've just checked myself.
In Windsor, it's a very large Town Planning and Zoning Commission public hearing this evening, so we'll see if we survive that. We are allowing call-in. We've had two town council meetings, including a budget hearing last week that had public comment feature. They could either we're using Zoom, so they could either use the question and answer feature and type in, and so all the council members could see what the question or comment was, rather, and then they also could speak in, call in and speak verbally, obviously. We didn't have a lot of turnout, which is not unlike Windsor's public hearings. Everyone just lays in the weeds until the last night. But it did seem to work for the two or three calls that we got. So tonight's the big test with Planning and Zoning Commission hearing.
Peter, this is great.
No, go ahead.
Well, this is Grace from Avon. I just had a question for the group. We're using GoToMeeting and have had a couple trial and errors. It's been going okay, but I was wondering if anybody had an executive session via a virtual meeting. We had a WPCA meeting, I think it was last week, and we needed to have an executive session. And the best thing we could come up with was was calling the meeting to order in a public session that was under one call-in set of call-in instructions, and then moving to go into executive session, having everybody hang up and having the board call in to a separate call-in line with a password so that they could have their executive session. And I'm wondering if anybody else has maybe had a better idea for how to go about going into executive session.
This is Melissa in Simsbury. We did something similar with our Board of Selectmen meeting last week. The executive session followed a long regular meeting, and I wanted to make sure. So the way we're doing it now, our public access, local public access television station is still, that's how we're getting it out, the meetings out to the public still. And this was a Zoom meeting, so the television station actually linked into the Zoom meeting for the regular meeting, and then I set up a different Zoom meeting for the executive session to just to make sure we were actually cutting the feed and not, no one else was getting into the meeting and it wasn't being broadcast still. So we essentially handled it the same way. We just ended that one Zoom meeting and then started another one and had them recall in.
All right. It was all I could think of, so I'm glad you had the same thought. Well, thank you.
We've been doing, this is Tony Moran again, we've been doing GoToMeetings, and we've instituted a password protection. We haven't had any difficulty. The first couple of meetings, people were very polite, and that ended last night. So it seems to work. People have to get used to the idea, but it does seem to work just fine. Our problem is that we have only one room where we can broadcast things from. So since public meetings have to be available to the public, even those meetings which didn't normally get broadcast will now have to be recorded and broadcast. So that's put some real limits on when and where you can meet.
Mm-hmm. Mike from Tallinn, did you have a question or comment?
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, actually, I was just going to say, I've noticed that our attendance has actually been better on Zoom than it has in person. More people are apt to just kind of call in and listen to what's going on, or, you know, maybe while they're eating dinner or something, tune in. I've kind of become our in-house expert on Zoom, and a lot of the things have already been said that we've been doing, but we've made sure that some learning, some growing pains, we've tightened controls as much as possible now for our Zoom. So we don't allow anybody else to share their screen. We don't allow anybody to share their video except for the specific people that the host, who's me, picks. The counselors can share their videos or invited guests. Everyone's muted. The question and answer portion is only done by raise hand option so that there's no chat box, because that's where the Zoom bombings are taking place. People are putting pirate links into the chat box. Anybody can see it and click it and then get ransomware. And I think that covers all pretty much the basic provisions that we do so that people can't either hijack the meeting or share inappropriate pictures. Or the only thing you can't control for is if somebody says something silly on the phone, then you can always just kick them if you have to, but at least it's on record who they are. And one other thing I know too, growing pains, click off the option that says don't allow people to rename themselves, because we had some jokers come in with some choice language. They renamed themselves as some four-letter words. So we figured it out. We've tightened up all the constraints now, and we're good going forward.
That was a rename option you called it, you referred to, Mike?
Yeah, it says allow participants to rename themselves. Check that off so that they can't rename themselves. So if they come in with a name, at least you know who they are, and they can't change it to something. We had somebody that wrote, you know, some F words and things on there.
Our public right. access is all either the public, this is Melissa again, either they're viewing it live on the streaming on YouTube through our public access station, or they're watching it on TV on the public access channel. So are we the only ones not allowing that sort of live link in to the meeting? I mean, people are allowed to submit public comment, but they have to do it ahead of time and then it's read out loud. So we don't even have that ability for the public to call in.
Bob, is that what you guys are doing in Plainville?
I think Bob stepped away for a little bit.
Yeah. I think Bob in Plainville said that they were just allowing comments, no call-in or say, quote-unquote, live comments. It was prior to the meeting.
Okay.
There were a few other towns that were allowing that as well from the CTCMA. They were doing voicemails and emails, and then they would read it out or play the voicemail in the public meeting.
Yeah. Even our budget hearing next week, that's how we're going to handle it. So we'll see.
And Melissa, this is Grace. That's what we're doing for our two budget meetings that we're having next month. We'll only accept comment via email or US mail, and then we'll read it into the record during the meeting and allow for questions to be answered and things like that, but no oral public comment at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You guys might be the smart ones. All right. Anybody have any other, anything else to add in terms of how we're doing public meetings? So, all right. Well, good
just
luck.
Just a question. Anybody inclined to continue this after all this is over? Is that a discussion anywhere?
I know my council is inclined not to continue it. Although we've always allowed for remote call-ins, because we've had a couple council members who tend to do a lot of traveling for business. And so we've allowed that over the years. Right. I know my mayor has already indicated that even though he likes sitting on his porch, he doesn't feel it's gives complete, he doesn't feel comfortable with it philosophically yet.
This is Tony Moran again. I think there are two reasons to meet in person. And one of them is the law, but the other is the social context is really important. I think the opportunity to have little chats aside between people who, you know, opposite parties or whatever, creates a social environment that leads to better collaboration. So we also have people who travel and have had people call in. I suspect we'll use this kind of format for people who are out of town in the future. At least I'll recommend it.
I do think though, Jack, we might be moving towards on a staff level for this, using this technology, maybe even for, if people like it, maybe even for some of the Municipal Services Committee meetings going forward, just to cut down on, you know, those folks that aren't fortunate to be real close to the CROG's offices. But
yeah, we're doing all our staff meetings this way, because two-thirds of my staff are working remotely in the IS departments anyway. Yeah.
Right.
It's far superior to a conference call.
All righty. Anybody else have anything else in terms of using technology for the public meetings? All right. I guess the next question is, looking at budget, anybody yet had the formal decision on which of the two local relief measures the governor has provided?
Yes.
You guys has anybody looked at deferment or the low interest or combining those two, or have you separated those out?
Peter?
Yes, Tony.
We did this last night. The recommendation, and it's in consultation with neighboring towns, was to go with the deferment, and to extend it to all taxpayers rather than requiring an affidavit to demonstrate that you have been personally affected by COVID. The idea was that the simplest thing to do is to allow people to extend the payment by the 30 or 90 days, depending on where you fall into the rules. I was initially very strongly in favor of the reduced interest rate because I think that the 18% interest rate that's statutorily mandated is far more than it ought to be. It just becomes, particularly if it compounds, it becomes an absolutely impossible burden for people who are really struggling. But the complexity of that had led to a recommendation from the town staff to go with the deferment and not with the reduced interest rate.
Mm-hmm. Is anyone else made that decision or leaning one way or the other at this point?
Peter,
go ahead, Bob. All right, Plainville is, council's going to make a decision next Monday. Town staff is recommending a deferment, not the lower interest rate, and we're going to restrict it to only those people who fill out the application. That's our recommendation. I think the council will follow it. We don't feel that it's necessary to apply it to everyone. I think that would discourage people who can afford to pay the tax to just wait another couple of months. So we're going to go with the deferment, fill out a very simple application, and we're going to extend the date. We're going to give people till the end of, till the August 3rd, due date date to fill it out, not to July 1st, not by July 1st. So we're going to put some notices out. That's what we're going to recommend to the council. Again, I think they'll follow our recommendation.
Bob, is there any, do you have a basic threshold in terms of how you're going to define COVID impact?
It's right in the form. If you look at the application, they just have to attest that they've been impacted by 20%. And we're not going to try to judge that. You fill out the form, you get it automatically.
Yeah. Okay. So you're going to stick with the 20%. Okay. Yeah.
Well, we're going to, if they sign the form and they check the box, they get it. Mm-hmm. I think I'm anticipating we're not going to get all that many. You know, maybe we get 200, you know, but that's better than 5,000.
Yeah. Okay. What are those folks doing?
What we're doing is we're going to have a Board of Selectmen meeting on Wednesday and we'll make our decision. But my recommendation is similar to what Bob said, which is, let's follow the program with the 20% impact. My concern of rolling it out to everyone was we would have potential cash flow issues because I think even if you got the money, if you got an extra 60 days, no penalty, you're going to, you may not be inclined to pay the bill at the normal time. So anyways, we agree with the complexity of the tax interest rate issues. So our tax collector recommended that we just go with deferment. And that's my personal opinion that I'm going to bring to the Board of Selectmen tomorrow.
Okay.
Simsbury's Board of Selectmen adopted both programs. The deferment is not for everyone. It's just for those who apply. By July 1, I believe.
Let's say Tallinn's in the same situation as Plainville and same thing, deferral program. Our finance director was heavily opposed to the low interest program. Just apparently it's an accounting nightmare is what she said.
I know we're going to go to the Windsor Council on Monday night with the recommendation of deferral. We're still chewing on, does it, the recommendation in terms of eligibility for everyone or restricted to the COVID impacted folks. So, but we agree that the delinquent piece of it would be is not best interest in just the complexities of that. So we'll probably go with deferment and then still open question about eligibility. We've got a little bit of challenge when since we're not doing the referendum, the council's got a little bit of a political community politic issue happening since we probably won't do a referendum.
Well, this is Robert Lee again from Plainville. Just so you know, as I understand it, the lower interest would apply to everyone, not just for the people who qualify. So that even makes it a lot more complex and would actually could discourage people who could afford to pay to delay making a payment because they said, it's only 3% annual. So,
right. That was our concern given the amount of commercial property that we have in town in Windsor. That was our concern as well, that some folks would just hang on to their money well into the fiscal year.
Peter, the deferments do not apply to anybody who has a mortgage. If your tax money is in escrow. So we figured that left a relatively limited proportion of our population. I mean, we're an older community, so we have a lot of people who paid off their mortgages already, but still there are a lot of people who are still paying. And so those payments will come in on July 1st or by August 3rd in any case. So it's not going to be a total loss of revenue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. All right. Anybody else seen any other budget impacts other than on the revenue, like for user fees and enterprise funds? Anybody else seen anything significant in terms of cost on expense side or?
Well, our community center just is losing $100,000 this April.
Yep. That's what we've got our. We've got a preschool that we run, and we're losing about $45,000 a month in revenue there. So, not to mention a number of our recreation programs as well are hurting. All right, going on to the kind of the question about, I think Pauline, this was a question that I'm not sure if it came directly from you or you're just thinking about how we kind of look at reopening the region, and clearly we're going to get some guidance from the governor but maybe you can phrase this question to kind of what you're thinking to intrigued by.
Yeah, I was thinking I had attended an ICMA webinar on just thoughts about reopening and how to go about it, and it got me to thinking in terms of we do, I mean, we're hoping, presuming that in a month or a little over, we will be doing some sort of reopening, but the projection is that there's going to be a second wave in the fall or the spring and winter, spring. I mean, it's and so the question is, I think we should start thinking about, do we want to put into place some sort of standards or something, recommendations in terms of how to open the spaces up. I'm sure all of you are thinking about your face-to-face contacts in terms of, I know a lot of towns are putting up the plastic barriers at the counters and things like that, but what other measures? I mean, is it when the second wave comes, are you going to take everybody's temperature who comes into town hall? And maybe I'm the pessimist who says when the second wave comes, but I am the pessimist who thinks that. I don't know about towns and their flows in terms of people flows. You know, if in your different departments that deal with the public, are you thinking about changing the flow of how people come in and how they exit? I know this is future, but it's not that far into the future. I know we're thinking about it at CROG, but it's very small in terms of the the amount of what we're doing because we're a small office and we don't have a lot of people coming through. So thinking.
Hello, Peter, I can just add a piece, and I apologize for some background noise here. We're starting to have a conversation about the whole reopening issue, and there's going to be a clear statement from the governor and then the issue of phasing, what gets reopened first. The second piece we're talking about, and Cheryl's going to be talking to public health directors this Friday, is having testing available, having tracing of contacts, and then having safe workplace guidance and some potential training around that. So this is something we're going to work on, where I think we could make a lot of different decisions if we had a clear set of testing availability, rather than sending people home for 14 days that might have something. If you can have a 45-minute test and say that, you know, Kim can go into work, we're good. So we're looking at, and again, this may be a question for the people on the call, and that is, we're going to get guidance from the governor, and the five states around us are going to coordinate that. But then we have the issue of, as I say, testing availability that can drive a long-term issue. As Pauline says, we're going to have this as at least 18 months probably until we have a proper vaccine available to everybody. But reopening criteria, phasing of criteria, then available testing, and then contact tracing, which is what the successful countries have done. And then anything on safe opening of workplaces, both to the public and to workers, in terms of PPE or procedures or handling and things like that. So this is something you may want to bring on a separate agenda. We can sort of brainstorm because we have a little time to work on this. So we'll get broad guidance from the governors. Then we'll get the question of testing availability, how fast that comes online. And then contact tracing is really a whole other issue, how that gets done, because it's in many parts of the country and the world, it's not only done by public health people, it can be done by public safety staff, it can be done by others, but basically finding out who's sick and where they're coming from so that you can then basically have very targeted quarantine. Because right now what happened in Northern Italy is if you had a cold, you were sent home, you know, in the healthcare system. Well, it wiped out the hospital capacity, and we can't have that. So that's the first point. The second point, as Pauline mentioned, is, you know, the best guess is this could be a 2 or 3 wave situation. So we need to have protocols in place so we can handle this and don't have to come to a grinding halt in 2 or 3 months if this thing recurs. So it hinges on testing, contact tracing, and safe workplace opening for workers and for people getting public services. So we're going to start working on this stuff. And I think to the extent we can work on this, some of the stuff might be regional in terms of training and acquisition of equipment. So just let us know if we can be helpful on this. But I think that's coming. I'm not as optimistic as Pauline. I think we're 6 weeks out, but it's going to be recurring, I guess. And so the hinging point really is the availability of fast, cheap testing would really change the dynamic here. Even if we have 2 or 3 waves, if you can, you know, the issue is if someone comes to the front door of East Granby, that you can, you know, zap them on the forehead with a thermometer and they're 100.4 or above, they say adios. Then you say, you know, you're feeling a little queasy, you get a 45-minute test, then it's you don't have coronavirus, you have a regular flu bug or a cold. So I'm just saying we have a little time on this, but so testing plus reopening phasing criteria plus worker and public protections. So we're at your disposal in terms of trying to think through some of this stuff. I don't know if Cheryl wanted to add anything on this, Cheryl, in terms of your discussions that you have coming up. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Cheryl?
Sorry, I was unmuting. Not at this point, Lyle. We are going to start talking with the public health director since I just talked with you about this yesterday. So I will start those conversations this week.
Yep. So just let us know. Again, we're going to get guidance on this from CDC plus the governors. But I think that as I look at this, one of the critical success factors is going to be availability of testing and contact tracing, and then sort of the workplace safety for workers and public in place. Yep. Because we're going to, and again, the best guessing, and not that it's good, is it's a 2 or 3 wave thing. We're not really out of the woods for 18 months in terms of getting a vaccine developed and then out and in place for everybody is a year and a half out. Right. Until then, well, you know, that's a long time. We need to plan. So anyway, that's sort of where we're at, Peter.
Okay. Well, I think that's something, you know, that we could you know, keep on the, obviously keep on the table, something that working with the public safety group, we can, you know, maybe that we put that on the, keep that on the agenda as we go through. And again, you know, obviously guidance will be important, but also just sharing the best practices and what we, you know, learn from each other. So, and just so you guys know, when I go to East Granby, Jim usually zaps me right in the head anyway. So he's, you know, keeps me.
Just as a matter of principle, I understand.
No extra charge.
Yeah, no extra charge. There you go.
No extra charge. Exactly. All righty. So
I have a question. I have a question that's sort of peripheral to that, but have any of you activated your medical reserve corps? It seems to me that contact tracing and that sort of thing might be something those volunteers would be appropriate for.
I'm not sure, Tony, that individual towns have medical reserve corps. The Capital Region Medical Reserve Corps has been activated, and they're doing various things within the region. We've deployed many of their assets out along with some people as well, but not for contact tracing as far as I know.
Yeah.
The other Medical Reserve Corps in our region is Middletown.
Because we've been recruiting volunteers for it, but I don't know what if there have been plans to use them.
That's true, because you're in the different Homeland Security region in Mansfield.
Ah, okay.
And us, yep. I know that they're recruiting volunteers through CT Responds, which is the new DPH app. Mm-hmm. And I'm not 100% sure what they're doing with them. They are giving them to us to make contact with some of the folks. And we've also seen that, you know, some healthcare workers have been furloughed because of the fact that, you know, the routine surgeries aren't being done, yeah, and things of that nature. So there's probably an opportunity there as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Cheryl.
Got a question. 18 months might be a long time out for vaccines, but the testing was supposed to be out a long time and has probably been a quarter of the time reduced. Essentially here now. If vaccines became available, are the health services going to make them available in the towns? Like we have vaccination cycles that we've been doing regularly.
Yeah.
The town nurses do those. Is there any chance?
And that seems to be the assumption that they would open up their you know, vaccination sites.
Would
be an, yeah. I think speculating.
Would that be through all the mass dispensing agencies?
It's going to be all hands on deck. It's going to be an emergency declaration in terms of vaccine delivery. It's not going to be the regular get to it when you get to it. And we
have. So the follow-on question is, do we require that in order to be able to come back to work? I mean, we're talking about recovery.
No, things. You don't. I mean, that's the whole point about 45-minute testing is you don't have to do all that with a thermometer and a 45-minute test. You don't start doing that kind of stuff. But you, and because it's going to roll out, this is going to be, you know, you don't do this instantaneously. I don't know what our compliance rate on influenza vaccination is, but it's not 100%. And you'll have the anti-vaxxer crowd and the whole nine yards. It's going to be simple to think about, but hard to do. But I think there'll be an all-hands-deck emergency management. It could be the National Guard could set up vaccination sites. Who knows? I mean, it depends on how fast you want to do this. So it's, they're not there yet, but we'll get there.
We did those model drills back in the N1 era there about 8 years ago.
H1N1, and SARS. No, this will be an all hands on deck, and it's much more serious. But the thing that's going to be tricky in the next future is, you know, how fast these 45-minute test things can get done, because that's the one you can do now. Thermometer plus 45-minute test, you can actually manage this thing a lot better. Vaccine's going to be a year and a half, I would say. So.
As long as you're not getting false negatives.
Well, it has to be accurate. It has to be accurate, which is the thing, but the other thing is contact tracing, which is what, you know, Taiwan, Korea, and South Korea and others did, which is you can actually nail this thing down with rapid testing and rapid contact tracing. You can sort of cut the compound interest aspect of this off really fast. And that's what many places have done. But I think testing is the thing to keep an eye out for. And we have several companies in Connecticut that might actually be doing that. I mean, developing this capability. So that'll be really important. So the vaccine is going to be, I think, we'll find an all-hands-on-deck rapid deployment as soon as it's available. and we'll get whatever gets done fast. I think that's going to be my two cents worth. But
yeah,
for me, so, keep an eye on fast, rapid testing at, that's accurate and low cost. That's going to be critical for the next year and a half, I would think.
So is there any other, just looking at the clock, it's 1 o'clock now. Anything else on the COVID discussion? Any other questions or items to share? Well, appreciate everyone providing that information that's helpful, particularly both the deferment and the low interest options. So let's look on to Pauline. Do we want to touch on the assessment study update?
Yeah, I think so.
Item number four.
Yep, I think so. This will be quick in terms of, we're just gonna, you have the, let's see, let me get to that. You have the presentation available to you, but we're just gonna sort of jump to the conclusions. And this is so that you sort of have an idea of what we did, and I'll turn it over to Jessica and where we are with that.
Great, thank you, Pauline. All Hi. Yours, Jessica.
All right, Jessica here. We'll just kind of skip really quick. We did a survey study of the assessment offices in the CROG area. 28 out of the 38 towns responded, which, you know, was pretty good. And then what we did was we went out and looked for some case study comparable counties by looking at places that did real estate, parcels, personal property, and motor vehicle taxes, and with a similar population size to the CROG area. And the two that were identified were Hennepin County and Pima County, and we called them to get some of their data so that we could compare the data that came back from the survey with these two counties that have county level regionalized assessment functions. Thank you for the next slide. So really quickly, the results is all of the FTEs that were collected were weighted to 35 hours. That was most common work week. So for CROG, we then looked at the number of real parcels, personal property accounts, and combined those to get FTE per parcel and personal property account rates. So for CROG, we look a little bit low on the 28 respondents, as compared to Pima, Arizona, and then in Minnesota, where we have for real parcels 2,500, almost 2,600 parcels per FTE. In Pima, it's 3,700, and for Hennepin, it's around 8,100 parcels per FTE. We also did a quick analysis of what we assumed the 38 would be based on the averages from the survey. So with all 38 towns encompassed, that's about 3,000 per FTE. However, then we added in the personal property counts, and it do personal property, but they just didn't have that many counts, they only had 1,300, so their rate didn't change that much. Pima added an additional 90,000, and CROG has about 77,000, or, you know, assuming with a similar rate with about 127,000 for all 30 towns. However, one hiccup was that while Arizona and Minnesota both have taxes on motor vehicles, those taxes are performed at the state level, and the assessment offices don't actually have to do anything, which is not the case for Connecticut assessment offices. So what I did was then did a recalculation, adding all of the motor vehicle counts into the personal property count, and that vastly changes our rates, whereas we're a little bit below the Arizona on the 28 respondents. You can see we're about 3,600 for real and personal property combined for FTE, and they're at 4,500, about 1,000 less. However, if you add in all of the motor vehicle accounts, that jumps to 10,000 and or more, where basically our assessors are doing more, have more accounts per FTE than even Hennepin, which was way ahead of us on real parcels. And then for CROG, the 38 sort of assumed projected, that's 4,100, so it's looking a little bit better for, as compared to Pima, Arizona, just without the motor vehicles, but adding the motor vehicles in, that's 11,500 accounts per FTE, so per 30-hour work week person in the office. So some sort of conclusions and caveats, I guess there's some evidence based on removing the just personal property accounts, not motor vehicles, and the real property, that regionalization might reduce the FTE and therefore the cost of regionalized assessment. However, because motor vehicle assessments make up such a significant portion of the non-regional accounts, centralization, we recommend that centralization implication at the state level would really be required to reduce the time and labor in a realistic way. So, and additionally, in my conversations with Pima and Hennepin, their county's offices work all assessment functions. Some of the suggestions at the state level were only to offload certain portions of the work, like back office functions, and it was not easy to tell whether that would be advisable or actually save FTEs in one or just layer in an additional layer of no initial step in the process when a lot of the work is coming from the addition of motor vehicles. In addition, just one caveat, we looked at the 2014 IAO study on staffing assessment across the U.S. and Canada. The average from that study per office was 15 FTEs with a median of 5, and Grog's average was 3. So we were under the IAO study on average. And then the average parcel per FTE was 3,100. And Grog's was per FTE for the 28 respondents was 2,600, and for the assumed projection of the whole 30 towns, almost 3,100. So about on par or slightly under the IAO study. Just finally to sort of wrap it up, we also looked at appeals, which was another part of the interest from the state regionalization proposals. And in Pima County, they had 3,300 last year. From the 25 towns that provided that data, we had 773. However, Pima County does its revaluation annually, so that might contribute. The various towns, we didn't collect data this time on the last time evaluation was done in each town. But the average appeals was 30 per year. We also looked at the structure of the boards. 64% were elected and 36% were appointed. We asked whether training was provided, and I did not find any statistically significant effect on training on whether the number of appeals. However, it's a small sample size of only 28 towns. There was a weak correlation between the number of appeals and whether board members were elected or appointed. Elected board members had slightly less appeals, but that might be due to a confounding variable, such as how long they've been doing it, whether they've been reelected many times, something along those lines that it was a weak correlation in the first place. So then just recommendations and sort of some next steps. Again, the motor vehicle assessment seems to have a major impact on our FTE rate. So if the state either simplified that process or took it over, as in Arizona or Minnesota, regionalized assessment and parcel per FTE increases might be more feasible. I'd also like to, if possible, go back and get further data from the remaining 10 towns so that we can sort of look at what those rates look like without having to project them from the averages. In the appeal process, I'd like to go back and collect some more detailed appeals data along with reevaluation dates to test the impact of reevaluation on the number of appeals. For the revaluation itself, go back and do some further investigation into revaluation methods and costs in similar sized counties with 5-year cycles, and then compare with the revaluation costs obtained from Krog towns and perhaps a subsequent survey from the primary towns. So that's
great. Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate all that work. There's a lot of good information here, and if there's some initial questions, that would be great at this point. I think, to be fair, Jessica, I'm not sure how much time folks had a chance to look at it, so I'd like to go spend some more time looking at it, but there's some initial questions from the group or reactions. Please feel free to share them at this point. I don't know if you're looking at the interest site, or can I take the average ability to let me go for free?
Thank you.